Hello everybody, this is Jamie, and welcome to Class 4 of Flow Fundamentals with myself and Stephen Kotler as your guides and instructors. We've got a lot of good things to do today, and we're going to start with what should now be a fairly familiar pattern. We're going to just go back over the ground we've covered, making sure that depending on how you've been coming in and how you've been watching or attending the classes, that all of the big ideas that we've introduced so far are fresh and established building blocks. And then we've got a special treat for us today. Stephen is going to get a chance to lead us all through really one of the kind of most interesting pieces that came out of his research and writing of Rise of Superman, which is specifically, you know, if the first question we get whenever we introduce flow content is, great, that sounds awesome, how can I get some more of that in my life? Pretty much the second question is almost always, and how can I bring it to teams or organizations or groups or communities that I'm a part of? Because what is it like when we all start experiencing flow together? So Stephen is going to introduce us to those triggers and really make, you know, really unpack that part of the world. And then we're going to go through the rest of our program and end with a pretty in-depth assignment, which should be hopefully a nice complement to what you guys did last week, which if you remember was to potentially identify the flow triggers from the action sports athletes and deploy some of those. Those were the mild, medium, and spicy challenges that you could then take on for your life. And we're going to add and build to that so that we continue to increase the challenge that you guys are experiencing as you get more skillful in your own flow practices. Okay? So with that, let's just bang through these things. Again, please remember, flow is a state. It is not a binary state. It's not on or off. It moves through a cycle. It is four stages, even arguably five, if you include the actual training in between the last one you've had and the next one you're going to have. But it goes through those stages of, if you remember, struggle, where I'm trying to solve it and can't, release, where I get away from my prefrontal cortex or amygdala, kind of in a battle for who's going to claim the day, and I release into the flow state itself, and then need to recover and integrate all of that information so that my next and new level up can happen. Best places to focus is kind of the get off the problem to solve it. Let's actually get better at struggling, which seems weird to say, but is essential. And, you know, as far as in the eat our own cooking category, I can personally attest that every time Stephen or I, either together as leaders or individually in our own, you know, in our own rows to hoe, whenever you get in the struggle phase, it sucks and you don't want to be there. But the more we can remind ourselves when we're in it that, oh, I am actually in it, which sounds kind of like a, you know, dumb statement, but it's true. We often lose our capacity. It's like slipping into a diabetic coma. At some point, you forget that you forgot to eat. When we're in the struggle phase, we can often forget that this isn't forever, and we can forget that it's a necessary prerequisite to what comes next. So let's focus on the struggle phase and getting better at picking and rolling, or getting better at kind of not just hitting things head on and actually finding more elegant or efficient ways around into that relaxation phase. And then that's also particularly true in our society in general, doubly, triply true for type A achievers, which is no sooner do we have some big flow experience or breakthrough and we're kicking ass and taking names and putting points on the board, whatever else you want to say about it, then we want to just keep going, never let that stop, which goes back to the first one. It's not just a light switch, and it does come and go, and to allow ourselves time such that we can annex all of those new sensory inputs, all of those new experiences, all of those new kind of somatic triggers or anchors, right, our felt sense of what it was like to play at that level, and actually integrate it through deep rest and recovery. Okay? The other part, this entire course is an example of this, as are many of the smaller assignments and exercises, but fundamentally we know that our confirmation bias, meaning we will see more of something when we're looking for it, right, we can make use of that to the positive when we start paying attention to flow. And that was you guys paying attention and posting on what has my flow experience been today, or to your friends, projecting them forward. All of those activities are helping more flow show up in your life simply by paying attention to when flow shows up in your life. Again, to add that kind of adult development component, right, we did the flow profiles. That was kind of what's your particular personality flavor or type, right? And the idea that we develop new complexity and capacity over time. So we're actually kind of constantly growing upwards, vertically, in different developmental stages from, you know, pre-conventional to conventional to post-conventional. And the cool thing about flow states is they give us glimpses. We get to poke our heads up above the clouds and experience post-conventional, literally beyond the norm, post-conventional states of being, which if we like them, if we can get there often enough, can almost become like new guideposts that we can then reel the rest of ourselves into. So by having a taste of those higher, clearer states, we can actually then raise the overall stage of our development to match and do it in less time. Okay? Simplest way not to get stuck in the amygdala hijack is through respiratory awareness and control. Said more simply, don't forget to breathe. And growth mindset is the idea that I am not an image, a persona, a sort of rigid or brittle sense of self. I am perfect. I am smart. I am talented, right? And instead, right, change those intransitive verbs, right, the I am, fill in the blank, and change it to verbs in progress, action verbs. I work, I train, I prepare, and my results are the sum total of the work, the training, and the preparation. If I don't like those results, if I get pulled into a struggle phase, rather than that threatening my core identity of who I think I am, which is going to be doubly, triply, quadruply painful, instead just be like, oh, wow, okay, I'm out of whack on my challenge skills equation. What's the best thing I can do right now? I can either back off from this challenge. I can live, you know, discretion is the better part of valor. I can live to fight another day. Or I can double down and I can expand my skills. I can train. I can practice. I can prepare more. Okay? Embodiment, flow happens while it may be a subjective interior experience, it happens more often and more readily when we're engaging a bunch of our body and brain and more sensory inputs. So we can do it with something intense, the classic adrenaline junkie. We can do it with something, you know, long and just punishing, right? It's literally, I go on a 30-mile ultramarathon, I do the Leadville 100 or the Hard Rock 100 or something like that, and I have some altered state of reality simply because I've beaten my prefrontal cortex into the dirt and there's nobody left, right? And the last one, repetition, and that's what we said with, you know, with walking, with gardening, with weaving, with throwing pots on a potter's wheel, any of those kind of just simple activities, which are often finer gross motor, right? There's a point to them. Even singing, swaying, chanting, any of the kind of indigenous traditions or religious traditions, they all harness that technique, right, such that it occupies our waking self with something that's, it takes some horsepower, but not enough for me to continue to pay attention to, and I've just kind of occupied my waking mind, and I have a flow state that way. And then lastly, just to bring us back to the content that we covered last week, right, action sports athletes, kind of accidentally, but now it's been 3, 4, 5 decades of this, we can kind of look back and spot the pattern. Have done a phenomenal job specifically hacking rich environments, go to cool, complex, beautiful places, deep embodiment, right? Do it with as many sensory inputs as possible, right? You know, our 5 senses plus proprioception, where are my limbs in space, plus our vestibular sense, where's my kind of center, right? And in relationship to my inner ear, in relationship to the 3 axes of gravity, all those things are really rich inputs, and high consequence, which gives me quick feedback loops, focuses attention, and keeps me explicitly out of the past or the future, which are the only 2 places that flow can't happen, compared to the only place it can, right here, right now, present moment. And by the way, as you guys did for your homework, those insights, the rich environment, deep embodiment, high consequence, are transferable. And that's what you guys did with your flow triggers worksheet, which was say, hey, mild, medium, spicy, out of each of those 9 categories that we identified, all right, what is a potential exercise or a potential challenge I could give myself, and now can I go and do it? Okay? And so here was just the refresh on the environmental triggers, the deep embodiment, rich environment, high consequence. And those were, for each of those, the 3 subcomponents. Which just gave us a sort of thinner grained slice at understanding how these work you know, both as a kind of academic exercise, how did these athletes do it, but more importantly, as a practical translative exercise, how would I use these to hack and improve my own flow experiences? Cool? So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Stephen, and Stephen is going to lead us through the social and creative triggers. And in fact, we're going to start right here.
Thanks, Jamie. That was great. Appreciate it. What we're going to do today is examine kind of the remaining 9 flow triggers that we didn't cover last week. The place I want to start is kind of where we started last week, which is kind of the overall big picture of these triggers, right? Flow, as Jamie pointed out, it's a present tense experience. It can only happen in the now. So all of these triggers are ways of driving attention into the now. Or to put it, you know, historically, these are the ways that evolution shaped our brain to pay attention to the now. These are the evolutionary kind of neon signs saying, this is important, I need your attention here. So last week we covered the external triggers, right? High consequences, rich environment, deep embodiment. These are environmental flow triggers, right? Right now we're going to turn our attention to the internal flow triggers, and these are psychological triggers. These are ways we can kind of alter our consciousness or our thinking on the inside to produce more flow. Hey, Jamie, you want to click the slide forward for me? So the first of the internal and psychological triggers, and this is arguably the most famous flow trigger ever. These were identified by Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, right, the kind of the godfather of modern flow research, who was chairman of the University of Chicago Psychology Department for a very long time. He's now at Drucker University, but he worked these out back in the 60s and 70s. They've also become the bedrock of expert performance theory, so there's been a lot of work done on them in that domain. For our purposes, we're going to kind of shift off some of the ideas in expert performance so they don't quite go far enough. And we're gonna kind of focus on how these things really drive flow. And the first, as I said, is the challenge skills ratio. And the idea here is that flow shows up most readily, meaning we pay the most attention to the present, when the challenge we're facing, meaning the challenge of the task at hand, slightly exceeds our skill level. So you want to stretch, but not snap. So I'm gonna give you what is the ratio between these things? Totally differs for individuals and everybody else and everybody in situationally as well. But a couple of years ago, Csikszentmihalyi sat down with a Google mathematician and they just did a back of the envelope calculation to come up with what they thought was the difference between challenge and skills. And the number they came up with, and this is just a placeholder, this is not science, this is just a way to think about it, is 4%. So there's a 4% difference between the challenge and the skills, right? My skills are 4% lower than the challenge, or the challenge is 4% greater than my skills. I will say that we took this kind of number, this arbitrary number, I've been running tests on it for about 4 years running, and I have found it is kind of amazing and has really produced great results. So I'm starting to gain a lot more confidence in 4%, and Jamie and I have been working with a bunch of different teams and trying to figure out a way to actually test this and get some real data on it. But what is 4%? What does that mean? What does this balance really feel like? So this is where things are tricky, and if you are less motivated, if you're a little more fearful, if you're a little bit of an underachiever, 4% is difficult because it is the point you start to feel pretty uncomfortable. Right, you've moved out of your safety zone, you've moved out of your comfort zone. You're now feeling pretty nervous about what's going on. For overachievers, for type A types, 4% is way too low. They blow by 4% without even noticing. They'll take on challenges that are 20%, 30% harder, and they'll burn out. And they will. It's too great. There's too much fear. It's constantly pushing them over into fight or flight. It's flooding the body with too much cortisol, too much norepinephrine. There's no way to kind of move. When your body's flooded with those things, if you look at this on an fMRI, it actually starts to look like you have OCD, or you're falling in love, because they both look the same. It's an obsessive kind of loop of thought. That's what happens when there's too much challenge, right? And what that prevents is you from moving through the flow cycle. You can't move, you can't relax, you can't take your mind off the problem. The norepinephrine is essentially keeping you locked in that loop when the challenge is too high. So even though your ego and everything about you, you know, is telling you, oh, I can handle this, there's a reason not to handle it like that. You know, as Jamie is really fond of saying, he said in this course, with most things flow, a lot of times you have to go slow to go fast. That's just how flow works. And at a deeper level, that is how we are wired biologically. You can't push through it because you're fighting your biology. You're fighting your neurology. It won't work. So to put this in just a personal perspective, 4% as a writer, when I am writing, this is the point at which I'm very vulnerable, right? I'm telling the truth at a level that I'm not quite comfortable with, or I'm communicating on ideas that are big enough that I'm a little nervous about trotting them out in public. You know what I mean? So that's kind of how I push on it in my own life. Athletes, I've seen athletes map out every obstacle on a ski hill or on a mountain bike hill and assign them gradients. Where is it compared to where I am now, and and using it as a blueprint for training and kind of riding and skiing over a course of a season. So that's a look at the challenge skills ratio. And there's a flip side to this, of course, because you're constantly driving up the challenge level, right? This is part of the dark side of flow. You're going to keep taking bigger and bigger and bigger risks. It goes with the territory. And, you know, there's really good data on it. There's a recent study that just came out of Germany that took a deep look at this. I talk about it in Rise of Superman, but you are climbing an escalating ladder of risk, and it's an issue. The tool to kind of get around that, and we talk about this in Rise, is lateralization, meaning if you've gotten too high and the next 4%, the next bit you need to bite off is just too terrifying, then it's time to break that goal into some sub-goals and kind of move sideways into another domain to start kind of pursuing this kind of tangentially. The example we give in Rise is when Ian Walsh, who's a big wave surfer, figured out something nobody had ever been able to figure out before in the history of surfing, which is, how do I paddle into jaws, right? How do I use my hands to paddle into jaws? It's been an impossibility. Big waves move about 30 miles an hour, and there's no way a guy windmilling away on a board can catch a big wave. But Ian had figured out there are points in the big wave where the wave actually went to vertical, and if he could take off there, he might be able to get enough speed. The problem was, he was bound to fall doing this. This was radical. Nobody had ever done this. For 1,000 years, we believed this was not actually possible, that it defied the laws of physics. But Ian saw this way, but it was terrified, and the biggest problem was he didn't know how to hold his breath very long. And even though he was a big wave surfer, he maxed out at 30, 40 second breath holds. Big waves can produce 4 minute breath holds, can hold you down for that long. So Ian went to free diving school. He learned how to breath hold free dive, and did that for two or three sessions over in Greenland, and then came back able to hold his breath for 4 minutes. So he lowered the challenge and then moved back into big wave surfing. So he lateralized, broke the big task and the sub skills, you know, walked up the same challenge skills ratio until it was applicable in the main challenge and moved back over. So that is the first of the psychological triggers, and arguably the most famous, as I said. Clear goals is the next one. And this is where I think a lot of expert performance theory gets it wrong. Now, goal setting in itself is incredibly, incredibly important. We've known, goal setting theory has shown as far back as the 70s, that simply creating what's known as a high, hard goal, a difficult challenge for yourself, you can increase motivation 11 to 25%. And this is organizationally and individually. And that's phenomenal. Clear goals are different from big goals. Clear goals are essentially all the chunked out things that you have to do on the way to big goals. And the point with clear goals is not so much the goals. They're important because they're a focusing mechanism, but the emphasis here has to fall on clear. Clarity is the real issue, and this is, I think, where a lot of expert performance theory goes sideways, and they don't quite seem to understand this. And the issue is that something is clear, when you know what you're doing and what you're going to do next, attention doesn't have to wander. You can stay focused in the now, which is the big point. So we've all seen, for example, famous chokes, somebody missing a putt in the last shot of the Masters, so quarterback fumbling the football to lose the Super Bowl in the last play, crazy stuff like that, and it's because the gravity of the goal has pulled the tension out of the now. So again, the emphasis has to fall on clear. So, they're small goals. When I start out writing, or when I talk to authors about this and other writers about this, I don't mean start my day, I'm going to write a great chapter. It's not even I'm going to write a great page. I often start my day trying to write a great 300 words. And that's it. It's a very clear goal. I can always add something on the other side, but I know exactly what I'm doing, exactly what a win looks like, and it keeps my attention in the present. Immediate feedback is an extension of this. When feedback is immediate, meaning there is no gap between cause and effect, we're always trying to improve performance. When feedback is immediate, you instantly know. You don't have to wonder how I was doing. You don't have to think about it. So you instantly know. This shows up in action and adventure sports all the time because they're in living environments. Feedback is immediate. If you don't set that ski edge on the top of the couloir, you're going to end up on a face-first death slide to the bottom, right? If you don't properly commit to a big wave, you're going to get pitched. You're not going to have enough speed. It's immediate feedback. When there are gaps between cause and effect, and when we don't know how we're doing, performance just drops off as well. So if you look in medicine, the only class of doctors who gets better after medical school are surgeons. Every other class of doctors, there's too much delay. They're not getting a feedback. Radiologists can read a radiological screen and not find out for 5 or 6 or 7 months if the screen he read looking for cancer, if the patient lived or died, right? And sometimes never at all. Surgeons get better over time because when they screw up, somebody dies. It's immediate feedback. So for maximum amount of flow, you want to kind of employ all these things at once. To give you a personal example and something I think is really worth thinking about when it comes to immediate feedback, in my writing, I have discovered that there are three things my writing should never be to stay on track, which is arrogant, boring, or confusing, right? So there is a guy on my staff who I pay specifically to read my work and tell me if those three things, right? It's fundamental. And what that is I figured out what is the minimal feedback I need for flow, and I put something in my life to make sure I get exactly what I need. The same thing can be done organizationally, right? But this doesn't mean quarterly reviews. Quarterly reviews is not immediate feedback. You need daily reviews. You need to know how you're doing and what you're doing at all times. So those are the three internal triggers, the psychological triggers. Next, we're going to jump to one creative flow trigger. And for this to make sense, you need to know a little bit more about creativity and what creativity is and what it does neurobiologically. So creativity is not these wild intuitive leaps, ideas popping out of nowhere, this kind of old magical idea of what creativity is. We now pretty much know in most cases that creativity is always the product of novel information, some new information, bumping into old ideas and old thoughts, right? Making connections, ideas linking together, new ideas, new information linking with old information, there's something startlingly new. It's always recombinatory. So if you dig under the hood of that, of course, you see a couple of things. One of the things you see is risk-taking, right? Because creativity really means kind of always taking a creative idea into the world. There's a practical component to creativity, so there's risk involved. But that's not exactly what we're talking about here. We're talking about the other portion of creativity, which is pattern recognition, linking ideas together. When we put ideas together in new ways, the brain releases dopamine. And you've all had this experience. Everybody's filled out a crossword puzzle, a Sudoku puzzle, and when you get an answer right, you get that little rush of pleasure. That's dopamine, right? And dopamine is one of the most potent chemicals for kicking you over into flow. what's better about this also is dopamine, one of dopamine's other features you might remember is that dopamine, it lowers signal-to-noise ratios in the brain. And what that means is you get heightened pattern recognition. This is why creative ideas tend to spire, and it's why creativity is such a potent flow trigger, because it's not like you're just pulling this trigger once, like you're linking one idea together. You're usually linking idea after idea after idea after idea. And this, again, shows up in crossword puzzles. When they run studies of how people do crossword puzzles, one right answer usually leads to a spurt of right answers, like three or four that follow immediately. This is literally dopamine doing its work, and it will drive you much deeper into flow. So if you look at action adventure sports, right, and people always say, well, what was the thing that happened? What changed the game in action adventure sports? Why was there nearly exponential growth? How did they kind of get on this flow hacking train? One of the most important things that happens was snowboarding showed up. Snowboarders were banned at most resorts, right? It wasn't really a sport. They weren't allowed to come to resorts. They couldn't ride the lifts, so they started going to the backcountry. In the backcountry, when you have to hike up the mountain to come down it, you don't want to be the fastest guy down. So this normal fastest guy to the bottom wins idea that had always kind of been in action sports went out the window. The competitive nature also went out the window, because in the backcountry, all need to work together to survive. So it became much more co-creative. And instead, how people kind of judged winners, if you want to use that term here, it was the guy or girl who had the most creative line on the way down. So they started putting creativity deeply into their sports. And in fact, if you talk to most top action adventure sport athletes, they think of themselves as artists much more than athletes. Dean Potter, who is one of the world's greatest climbers and one of the world's greatest wingsuit pilots and base jumpers, talks about his arts. He doesn't talk about his sports. He talks about his art. A lot of people feel the same way. They flooded action sports with creativity. They made creativity a fundamental core value. And as a result, they started pulling this flow trigger over and over and over again, right? And you see this is in organizations as well. Organizations that value creativity have way, way more flow. So speaking of organizations, up till now, the seven flow triggers we've looked at so far all work at an individual level, right? This is about producing individual flow. There is another kind of flow, which is group flow. This is what happens when a bunch of people get into a flow state together. And we've all had this experience. If you've taken part in a brainstorming session, if you've sung in a choir, if you've played in a band, you've been to a rock concert, right? You've tasted group flow. The whole group comes together. You see this in sports and football. Any of you seen a fourth quarter comeback where everybody's in the exact right place at the exact right time and it looks magical? That's what group flow looks like. Same thing in basketball. Same thing in soccer. Same thing in all the sports. There are five social group flow triggers that are really worth remembering. And they're made up of a bunch of different components. And the one thing I do want to mention is all of the other flow triggers also apply. They also are important for group flow. Some more than others. Some are worked into the list of group flow triggers. But, for example, in group flow, to trigger it, you need clear collective goals, right? Everybody has to share the same group goal. The group has to be on the exact same page. You also have shared consequences, right? So everybody has some skin in the game. Outcomes are important to everybody. There's group risk. It's a shared risk. The next thing you have is familiarity. Familiarity means the group has been together a little while. We know each other's tendencies. We know each other's tics. We know if you're an improv comic, you know in which direction other members of the group are going to take a joke. You have a sense of where it's going to go. You have a sense of everybody's talent level and how that you can trust them. Same thing in a band. Same thing in a brainstorming session, right? So familiarity is really, really important. And I also want to extend this out a little bit, because I think it also, if you're an action adventure sport athlete, I think familiarity extends to the environment, right? You want to be familiar with your environment. If you're going into very exposed environments on a mountain bike ride, you're going to a Moab to ride Moab for the first time, you know you're going to be around a lot of exposure, get out and, you know, hike some high ridges before you go, get familiar with the exposure. So it's not just individual familiarity, it's also, I think, environmental familiarity. So crisp communication is the next one, and there's a lot of kind of qualities here. The first one is kind of active listening, right? But for communication to be crisp, you have to be listening to what the other person is saying. You can't be thinking about that sarcastic comment they made 10 seconds ago because it's pulling you out of the now. You can't think about the witty thing you're going to say next, to impress the group. You have to be totally paying attention to the now. That's what crisp communication means. So a sense of control involves a couple of different things. First of all, it involves some autonomy, right? The group has to be there because they want to be there. The other thing with a sense of control is people want to have the requisite skills. They want to be able to participate in the group and kind of equally, right? Equal participation is a part of this as well. You need everybody involved. It doesn't mean everybody has to talk for exactly 6 minutes in the brainstorming session, but it means that everybody has to contribute for sure, right? And that's part of the sense of control. But competence is the real core here. Finally, additive thinking. Additive thinking means that interactions need to be additive more than argumentative. And the best example of this is the first rule of improv, which is always say yes, or always say yes and. What this means is, in improv, if you're running a sketch, you don't ever want to say no. If I say, hey, if somebody comes up to me and says, hey, there's a blue elephant in the room, and I say, no, that's not, shut up, that's stupid, the skit goes nowhere. It kills it, it just dies on the vine. But if I say, oh, wow, there's a blue elephant in the room, is it using my hairspray? Well, now the joke is going someplace. It is additive. Now, the thing to remember, and this kind of comes out also of the literature on brainstorming, when they first came up with brainstorming, they thought additive meant always positive, right? There was no bad idea. Turns out that's not what we mean. I think if you look under the hood of this, what you actually see is that you need some risk in your additive thinking, right? When there's no criticism, there's no consequence, there's no risk, you're not paying as much attention. What this means is you can criticize, right? But you have to find something positive in thinking. So I could, you know, Jim just talked for a while, I could say, well, I disagree with almost everything you just said, but that one idea you had in the middle, that was great. That was fantastic, and I think we could take it that way. That is additive thinking. So you want all of these at the same time, as much as you possibly can, right? And this is, again, what you really saw in the past 25 years in action sports, right? You saw a lot of kind of action sport meccas develop, places like Jackson Hole, Taos, Squaw Valley, where everybody kind of was coming together, and all five or six of these triggers were woven through every activity they were doing. So, again, it helped them drive into flow. But you see this organizationally. Organizationally, they are really good. These group flow triggers really triggered a lot. In fact, Facebook, probably more than almost any organization I know, has really totally privileged group flow above individual flow. They've, in a lot of cases, they've removed their desks. They've got standing desks. Everybody's facing each other in a circle. One of the reasons they're in a circle is it massively increases immediate feedback. When the guy across from you is having problems coding, right, you can see it immediately, and somebody can immediately go over and try to help. Communication is there. There's much better communication because everybody's in the room. Geeks have a tendency to, you know, silo out, and they'll only send each other emails. Now they're on walking distance facing each other. It has to be good communication. There's built-in familiarity. So they're getting tremendous amounts of group flow. Which brings us to the slide you're looking at, which is the Red Bull Air Force. So I kind of want to talk a little bit about, and if you've read Rise of Superman, the story is probably a little familiar, but I want to talk about a little bit of what's possible at the upper edge of group flow and what's there and kind of why it works so well. So the Red Bull Air Force, I guess it's 10 years ago now, Michael Bay was shooting Transformers 3. And he happened to see a 60 Minutes episode where the Red Bull Air Force, led by J.T. Holmes, who's the guy up front, was flying around, I believe, Switzerland at the time. And he thought, oh, wow, this is amazing. I want to be the first director to put wingsuit flying into a movie. and he contacted JT, and they created together what was a series of, including the most difficult wingsuit jump that's ever been attempted, and they jumped off the top of the Willis Tower, the old Sears Tower in Chicago, the tallest building in Chicago, and the jump itself was insane. So first of all, these guys had to fly in absolutely tight diamond formation, you know, very close to each other, 3 feet, 4 feet away, right, to pull this off. They decided to jump off the south side of the Willis Tower. The jump had all kinds of crazy variables. The first problem was wingsuit flyers only like to fly in about 10 miles an hour to 15 mile an hour conditions. That's kind of, after that, they shut it down. When these guys poked their head over the side of the Willis Tower for the first time, the wind was gusting up at them at almost 40 miles an hour. Because wind moves through a city like a pinball machine. It does in the mountains. It flows like a river, but it's a pinball machine. And right by the Willis Tower is exceptionally violent. To make matters worse, there were two ledges. There was one 90 feet down, so they had to jump and clear this turbulent air and get their wings powered up to clear this first ledge, which was 90 feet down, and they were going to splat. There was a second ledge 700 feet down, and then once they cleared the building, they flew into one of the most difficult urban obstacle courses you could ever imagine, which included one turn that was 110 degrees at 150 miles an hour. They pulled 4 G's at the height of that turn, and when they were pulling those 4 G's, so that's about 1,000 extra pounds of weight on your body, they were 10 feet off the building. They started calling it Suicide Corner. And one of the reasons they were calling it Suicide Corner is because they had no idea how to make those turns, but B, to make that turn, right? JT is at the front of the diamond formation. By the time he's initiated his turn, if the other guys are waiting for his body to move, they're going to miss, and they're literally going to crash into the building and splat into the side of the Willis Tower, you know, 1,000 feet in the air at 150 miles an hour, and, you know, show over. So what they did is they went to Switzerland for a month and essentially trained up group flow, right? And they did everything to increase familiarity. They found mountains that were as tall as the Willis Tower, and they practiced swooping down it. They found mountains with ledges. They did everything they possibly could. And what is so cool here and how it worked and why they pulled it off is what happens under the hood with group flow, right? So under the hood, a couple of things. You see pattern recognition, as we know, jacks way, way up in flow, right? So what they were doing to fly together, how do you initiate a turn if you can't wait for the guy to turn? This, you have to learn to read emotion. You have to learn to predict the future literally from the back of a guy's shoe, because that's all they could see. So you had to know what he was going to do before he did it simply by information conveyed from the back of a shoe. So that is the level that they jack pattern recognition up to. They also amplify future prediction. Future prediction basically is what the brain is doing all the time. If you're going to approach a door, before you get to the door, your brain is making all kinds of predictive calculations. How is the handle going to feel? How is the handle going to turn? How is the door going to open? Is there going to be resistance? Is it going to be light or darkness on the other side of the room? All those things your brain is trying to predict. When reality matches our predictions, right, we turn the handle and there's no resistance, we walk through the door and the light's on, we don't notice. Everything's normal. When something doesn't match, the door handle doesn't turn, it stops and it catches our attention, right? So they needed to amp up their ability to pattern recognize together and to predict the future together. Both of these things come together, and if you talk to people who describe it, it feels a lot like telepathy. It really, if it doesn't feel normal, it really does actually sort of feel telepathic. There's another quality here, besides the amplified pattern recognition future prediction, to pull this off, you need massive, massive, massive amounts of trust, which is also what group flow gives you. So we've talked a lot about the neurochemicals that underpin flow. All of these neurochemicals are social bonding chemicals. They're the most potent social bonding chemicals the body can produce. Norepinephrine and dopamine underpin romantic love. So when you fall in love with somebody, that is what is causing that crazy, obsessive, amazing feeling, right? Norepinephrine and dopamine, which you get in flow. Endorphins are maternal love, the bonds between mother and infant in children and in adults, it underpins all social bonding. Mandamine, right, which is the endogenous internal version of THC, right, the psychoactive in marijuana, as anybody who's used marijuana knows, creates this extensive I love you bro sense, right, that's anandamide. And serotonin also underpins social bonding, right, a couple of weird ways it makes you less fearful of other people as well. So all five of these chemicals show up in flow, so it means flow is essentially the ultimate team-building cocktail, right? So everybody has done team building offsites where you go do the ropes course together and you have to work together and there's risk and right. They're trying to produce group flow. Why? Because they want these neurochemicals because they will bond teams together really, really tightly. And it was these bonds on top of the advanced pattern recognition and team production. Group flow also produces that allowed them to pull off the team through base jump. So I'm going to kick it back over to Jamie. That is kind of the review of the triggers. And the one thing I want to leave you with is what happened in Action Adventure Sports. How did this work? Why was there near exponential growth? Because they packed their lives with these 12 triggers. Everywhere in their lives, everywhere you possibly could put these triggers, they put these triggers. Other people who are not Action Adventure Sport athletes who have wanted to massively increase the amount of flow in their lives, have done the same thing. I, Jamie, Michael, we have built our lives around these flow triggers, trying to get access to them as much as possible, right? And it's these triggers, you know, as you're coming to the end of struggle, right, as the ideas are starting together and you put in your training, right, these are the triggers you want to start playing with, right? This is how you move through struggle more quickly. All right, sorry about that, Jamie. Over to you.
Thanks, Stephen. Yeah, that was a great overview. And before anybody even gets the seed of the wrong impression about us having built our lives around these flow triggers, our best efforts, our best informed and inspired efforts are still messy and wildly imperfect. And even when you do try and do that. And one of the best things that I've heard is, I think it was a comment from Bruce Lee regarding martial arts, but he said, you know, you don't actually fight from form, meaning from the, you know, the specific routines and movements that you spend all your time practicing in the mirror or practicing in class. He said you fight to form, meaning that's your ideal, that's the ultimate balance state, that's the most precise or efficient way to kick or punch or block, but life happens. Right, you don't get into a bar fight in the middle of one of your polished routines. You get in a bar fight when some guy cold cocks you with a Budweiser long neck, right? And you have to pick yourself off of the ground and fight to form. So the idea here about making use of flow triggers is not that we necessarily get the luxury of a completely static and sterile environment and then we just go out and just build our life around those triggers. It's messy, it's imperfect, and we're forever struggling towards having those triggers effectively and accurately placed in our life versus some massive top-down experiment where everything then works swimmingly. So just permission for all of us to be messy and human, because if we didn't have that as a framework, we might find ourselves stuck in a fixed mindset, right? I'm a loser, this sucks, I tried or I can't pull it off, and we might find ourselves, you know, stuck in the struggle phase that much longer. So as we move into this section now, I want to give you guys just a sense of, okay, if I'm interested in experiencing flow with others, the group flow component, how can I help that? And obviously the most tempting thing we want to do is go talk to people, talk at people about group flow and how to do it, which is generally the lowest likelihood success. As anybody who's ever read a self-help book and then attempted to pass on those nuggets of wisdom to their spouse can attest, right? It's got a very low success rate. Far better to try and model it ourselves. And if we think about, you know, a great example of group flow are musicians, especially improvisational musicians, right? And what is the best way I can increase the likelihood of me having fun improvisational jams with other musicians? Well, the simplest is for me to be absolutely rock solid on the beat. If I know where the one in a four-bar blues is, and I know it backwards and forwards, and I can play with it, and I can come in behind it, I can come in ahead of it, I can skip it, right? But I am locked on the one, right? Then my ability to jam to make things up on the fly with others is that much stronger. And I can even help others who may or may not be quite that tight drop into it if I'm laying down that groove. And in fact, the Carter family, who were famous, kind of as old-timey bluegrass, kind of grand old Opry kind of family back in the day, kind of one of the cornerstones of that kind of Johnny and June, June Carter, right, Johnny Cash, Ring of Fire kind of legacy, right, that when they were kids, they used to meet on the front porch, one of them picking a banjo, one of them playing a fiddle, and they used to go off in opposite directions around the big old wraparound porch on their farmhouse. And if they were still on exactly the same beat when they met in the back of the house, then they knew they had the song taped. So with that as kind of a framework, I want to give us an opportunity to kind of come back to ourselves, meaning if we're not on the one, if we're not in the present moment ourselves to anchor it, then it's much, much harder to precipitate or lead group flow in others. And one of the most typical ways that we get thrown off from actually being in the present is that our body isn't there, right? Our body is usually just kind of an ignored transport vehicle for a head on a stick. We may not be paying much attention to our breath, which we've talked about at length as the simplest hack back into the present moment, because that is exactly where our breath arises and inhales and exhales. But then also our bodies ourselves. And for any of us over the age of 10, our bodies aren't in the present, right? As you're sitting, can you feel the accumulated effects of a whole bunch of sitting, right? Do you have slight tension in your low back? Do you have an injury in a knee or a shoulder or a neck? Right? Think about all of the emotional muscles and memories that are stored in our faces, right? These are the accumulation, right, of past events that are impeding on our body actually being aligned, alert, attuned in this present moment. So again, we can fight to form here rather than from form. We don't need to beat ourselves up with some perfect ideal we're not. We can simply say, I am who I am with all the lumps and bumps that I've accumulated along the way, but I can pay more attention to being tuned into my body in this present moment. So what we're going to do is just a sort of 3 to 5 minute guided body scan, and hopefully that it won't in and of itself won't change much, but as a tool that we're going to introduce you to, it's the kind of thing that we can use on a regular basis before engaging others, so that metronome, we become the metronome for the present moment. We become that one beat, that pulse, that others can then align around. Okay? So what I'd like to ask everybody to do is please go ahead. Actually, please, if it's possible for you, if you're driving in a car and just listening or something like that, it's not. But if it is possible for you, please go ahead and stand up. And stand up straight, shoulder width apart. Again, this is optional but preferable. If you have the ability to be barefoot, go ahead and be barefoot. It's even better than our usual of wrapping our feet in leather and rubber and somehow hoping that we actually can know what's underneath us. So if you can be barefoot, be barefoot. If not, don't worry about it, but just have a nice relaxed stance, feet shoulder width apart, back straight. Take a nice big tall breath and almost imagine your ribs and spine kind of extending like an accordion, so it sort of get longer. Send your head towards the ceiling, and as you exhale, keep your rib cage at that height. Don't let it settle back down. So just exhale till your belly kind of gets very thin. It's almost like your belly button is collapsing back to your spine. Do another one of those. Just kind of ratchet up tall, extend as high as you can, and then just exhale through your belly button as it compresses to your spine. Okay, so now what we're going to ask you to do is basically a body scan using our hands, right? We're going to actually trace our hands over our whole body, and I'll give you guys instructions. And would like you to think of them almost like if you've ever been in a city where you've, or, either the guys down on the street looking to squeegee your car windshields or the big dudes on the scaffolds going down the skyscrapers, right? Think of your hands as squeegees, right? And we're going to start on the top of our head, and we're going to squeegee our whole body. We're just going to just drag them down the front of our body, all the way to our feet, and then back up the backs, right? And just want you to pay attention to anywhere that you find or notice tension. And just, first of all, just inhale and exhale. So just breathe. There's nothing particular to be done other than notice where you are tight, notice where you're relaxed. And as your hands come down, just visualize. And again, this is made up, right? This is imaginal. So it's not like, is this actually real? Just visualize the idea of as your hands pass, right, you're leaving a clear, clean window. Okay? So let's go ahead and put our hands on the top of our head. And first, just sense, what does the top of your skull feel like? All right, and actually just kind of wiggle your fingers around. Actually feel your scalp a bit. Notice if there's any tension there. Notice how it feels to actually have your hands up there. It's kind of an unusual spot, other than a pat or a taking or removing of hats or brushing of hair. So just actually sink your hands into your skull. Very, very slowly now, begin to move your hands from the top of your skull to your forehead. And just let them slowly pass down to your eyebrows. Let your fingers splay a little bit and kind of spread out through your eye sockets. Go super slowly here. Cross the bridge of your nose, the side of your nose, your cheekbones, and just allow yourself to lightly massage your cheekbones, even your eye sockets. There's tons of micro muscles in our face and hands and feet. So there's tons of sensory inputs here. There's also tons of muscular memory. Come on down your face to your cheeks. Just apply this gentle traction. Find your jaw. Give it light circles, just light pressure with your fingers. Relax your jaw. Trace your jaw all the way to your mouth. Feel your lips. Your chin. Fingertips coming under your chin, down your throat, to your Adam or your Eve apple. Slowly down the. Just feel how that feels. Just have your fingers trace across your windpipe. That's generally a fairly vulnerable sensation. We don't like to be karate chopped or choked. Feel your collarbone. Come down your chest. Feel your sternum. Feel your chest muscles. Again, thinking of the squeegee now, and we can be moving a little bit more smoothly as we go through the larger parts of our body. Down your rib cage, and actually imagine stretching out the spaces between your ribs. We often get very compacted, especially on the front half of our body. Everything is causing us to hunch and roll forward, chairs, cars, computers. So extend, stretch those out. Come down to the abdomen. Again, a place we rarely receive much direct touch or pressure. Right? Even professional massage folks, for liability reasons, still steer totally clear of our bellies to knees. So just keep moving your hands down. Go to your actual hip joint, like where that big, huge femur bone connects to your pelvis. Just applies pressure there. Keep going with the squeegee. Come down the front of your thighs. Just notice where they're tight. Notice where they're relaxed. Come to your knees. Feel the patella. Feel that actual kneecap. The thing that hurts so much when you ding it. right? Just move that kneecap around clockwise. See if it can move. See if you even have a nerve loop that connects what it feels like to move it independently of the rest of your legs. Go down your shins. Reach your fingers around your calf muscle as you slide down your fibia and tibia, right, or shin bones. Go down to your feet, across the tops of your feet, all the way down to your toes. If you need to bend your knees to do that, please do so. Be comfortable to the extent you can. Bring your hands around to your heels. Come up your Achilles. Come up your calves. Tracing all the way to the back of your knees. Up through your hamstrings. For most of us, our hamstrings are ridiculously tight. Just feel those. Keep your hands coming slowly up the hamstrings. Feel the difference, the transition from your hamstrings to your glutes. Come up your backside very slowly. Come to your, basically your sacroiliac joint, your place where your hips and your spine connect. Reach back to the small of your back. This is where your kidneys are. Right. Bring your hands up your rib cage on your backside this time, as high as you can. And then right when you get to about where your underarms are, just bring them back around to the front. Have them meet over your heart. And then take a big breath. And then exhale with an extreme whoosh and fling your hands forward. So inhale. Exhale. Okay. Please go ahead and sit back down quietly. Keep your feet balanced on the floor in front of you. Keep your back straight. Keep your jaw loose, relaxed. Tongue on the roof of your mouth. Eyes soft focused, gazing ahead. And notice how you feel. And focus on your breath. All right. So thank you guys for playing along on that. That is just a simple, sort of via our hands, way to get out of our head. And sort of put our focus of attention in another body part, and actually a very sensitive body part, right? All of our 10 fingers, able to pick up information and sensation, and also potentially, identify and release tension. And I don't know about you guys, you may have had to engage, more of your prefrontal cortex, more executive function to simply be listening and following instructions. But for me, by the time I had sat down, I actually didn't have any thoughts. I was just I had completed that exercise or movement pattern, and my head was relatively empty. So that can be a nice way to prime yourself, to relax, or to in active recovery at the end of a day, or certainly in preparation. And if you want to combine it with the heart rate variability trainings that we've got, we have the Stress Doctor app, or any of the more sophisticated and advanced custom-specific tools for heart rate variability. Those are two great ways to actually be able to, back to the musician's example, train ourselves to be attentive to where the beat is, and then be able to model that beat. Again, it's nonverbal. It's with affect, it's with body posture, it's with facial expression, it's with vocal tone, it's with a host of things other than the teleprompter in our heads. But we are better able to then lead and create coherent group flow states using the triggers that Stephen described to us earlier. Okay? So that leaves us our next and potentially one of our more challenging assignments for this course. And the idea here is one on group flow. How can we get better at playing with others? And rather than asking you to go find the tallest building in your town and take a 40-gallon hefty steel sack and practice your base jumping, we are going to give you a simpler but no less potentially risky, but hopefully a whole lot safer experiment to conduct this week. And to do that, we're going to figure out a way to interact with another person. So we're going to start simple, just one other person at a time, in a way that you might not normally, right? And to give you guys instructions on what this might mean. Because if we can create unusual flow-like or straight-out flow experience with others, it's a muscle we build. It's networks in our brain we start cementing. It's also great relationships we start deepening. And it's a ton of fun. So in general, most of us, thanks to our executive functioning prefrontal cortex, tend to move through life with a whole bunch of certainty that the way we see the world is the way the world actually is. Always. And when we bump into others, right, it's usually some form of tug of war, right, between those competing perspectives. So if I come home and my wife is running the model of you're 45 minutes late and you are a selfish husband who isn't helping me run the house, and I say, oh, no, you don't. I am out there selflessly, right, working for our family, busting my ass, burning the midnight oil, and I, in fact, deserve special care and attention, right? And you end up with a competing stories of which they seem to be mutually incompatible, and we usually end up in a pitched battle. And if I lose, if I take a hit to my story, then, you know, back to fixed and growth mindsets, if I identify with my story, right, I have taken that as an affront to myself and my self-sense, right? And it's usually fairly messy. We usually do a crap job of listening to each other, and we usually end up with what are kind of known as Pyrrhic victories, right? Those ones where, you know, yeah, I might have won the argument, but I just destroyed the relationship, or at least I destroyed our weekend, right? So that sense of most of us, most of the time, go through life thinking we've got 100% of the reality or truth, okay? In the last 30 years or so, you know, the advent of nonviolent communication, the advent of family and couples therapy, all these kind of things, we kind of got this idea of, well, you know, the other person has valid points of view and you need to hear them, and like, you know, let me rephrase that to make sure I understood you correctly and those kind of things. And it's all, you know, valid and noble and a definite step in the right direction. But for many people, it ended up feeling kind of gutless, mushy, muddy, and losing a lot of that precision and shared consequence that Stephen was talking about, that accountability that makes us alive and on edge. Is there something really dynamic here, something more? And if you guys have ever heard that expression, right, that a horse designed by committee looks a lot like a camel, you can kind of see the sort of, you can imagine the downside, which is we lose the spiky, the edges, we lose the precision, we even lose the thrill of my perspective passionately held, and we can end up with vanilla, which is satisfying to no one. So here's the invitation, and this is the potential innovation that we're asking you guys to play, which is, what if, just as a mental and, you know, social thought experiment, I come to the conclusion that instead of holding 100% of reality, I only, max, walk around with 30% of it. That's it. No matter how convincing those puzzle pieces in my pocket seem, they are only 30% of the actual big picture. And this other person, they too hold 30%. And if we can get together and dump our puzzle pieces out, we might be able to create another third or another 30%. Right, so this 30-30-30 rule. Instead of me thinking I've got 100% of reality and exclusive claims to truth, or thinking that we just have to mash ours together and average them out and call that good enough, right? Let's play a different game. Let's be actively curious about what the other person has, but then let's understand that when we put these two data sets together, we will see patterns. We will uncover truth. We will invalidate and validate different hypotheses and assumptions that we never could have if we'd just done a blind average. So then we get this possibility, right, of something novel emerging, that final 30, right? Then we get this possibility, right, where there's dopamine reward. We're not sure what we're going to see, right? But it could be really fascinating. It could be interesting. And when Stephen and I get to bat around ideas, right, a classic example, like, you know, he's got a perspective on, you know, an application or an insight around flow, and then I'll have one. And we'll go back and forth, and we'll be, you know, naturally, we both like to think we've come up with a good idea, right? And if we just went back and forth unilaterally, then the phone would end and hang up, and he would go ahead and write what he was going to write anyway, and I'll go ahead and do or say what I was going to do anyway, and we didn't get any better from it. Now, we can also say, hey, let's just temper both of our ideas with the other's perspective. That's kind of standard copywriting or editing. Great, that's a step in the right direction. But when it's most exciting, and Stephen, I think you would concur on this, right? When it's most exciting is when we get through that phase, we've gone through our kind of, you know, intersubjective struggle phase of like mine versus yours, we relax into, hey, I'm actually not that attached to my singular point of view anymore, and we're now both acutely listening for that third. What's that thing that wants to emerge? And that's where it gets thrilling. That's where it gets exciting. Because now, from prior to the phone call, I knew what I knew, right? And Stephen knew what he knew. By the end of that phone call, we are both beginning to know something that neither of us could have, right, prior to engaging that conversation. So here's the three-step process that we're going to invite you guys to do. The first thing to do, right, is get back into the present moment, right? The same way we just did that body scan, just to try and center ourselves in our physical forms, right? We often spend an awful lot of time psychologically, right, wrestling with what's actually right in front of us. We almost always have a preference for it having turned out some other way. That's why proms, graduations, and weddings are usually such catastrophically depressing affairs, right? Because people have these massive built-up expectations that very rarely ever come true for those kind of flashbulb marquee moments, and an awful lot of people just end up bummed and disappointed. However, if they'd just shown up for any of those evenings, they would have all been probably quite pleasantly delighted and surprised, right? So this idea is, first of all, right, it's practice gratitude for what is, including, wow, I have a friend that cares enough to be mad at me or to tell me something I really didn't want to hear. By the way, my other 10 friends feel the same way. They were all just gutless and would rather just get drunk on the weekends with me. Right, but this one friend, can I practice gratitude even in the struggle? Right, back to that struggle phase. When I'm dealing with a reality I would prefer to be different, can I actually focus on my breath? Right, first of all, get my body back to a recognizable spot. And can I get my prefrontal cortex, instead of kicking out into it ought to be this way, it should be this way, it has to be different, and actually experience gratitude for this exactly as it is? Right, George Leonard, who was one of the kind of founding pioneers of the human potential movement back in the 60s and 70s, had a great phrase that he borrowed from his Aikido practice, which was, take the hit as a gift. Take the hit, this fact that I am not actually having my 100% worldview validated right now, take that hit, because it hurts, take it as a gift, and be grateful you have an opportunity to update your map with more valid data. Okay, so that's the first basic thing. Accept what is and practice gratitude, including that uncomfortable conversation you're about to have. Number two, right, move this into the space where instead of me, right, and this is the subtle shift, if I think I've got 100% of reality, I'm going to spend 100% of my time trying to convince you of it. I actually don't even want to hear what you have to say. I want you to understand and then believe what I have to say. But if I know I've only got 30% of this thing, now I know that's partial. I know it's partial. And in fact, I have to actually show up with curiosity. I have to show up, in fact, looking for the missing puzzle pieces. And when I know that, right, I know what third I've got. I know what my puzzle pieces look like. So instead, I'm going to set them aside for now. I am solely and exclusively trying to understand the other person's world. okay? And that is not point-counterpoint. That's not I'm storing ammunition for my cross-examination later, and that's not a yes, 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 but, right? That is actually trying to understand what it looks like and feels like from their point of view as them. That's the game. And that's not one we're actually generally very good at. We haven't seen it modeled. There's not a lot of places that train for this kind of thing. And if you want to think of the business world, an application would be customer ethnographies, right, where you've got a bunch of guys in suits behind a one-way mirror, and they're asking, you know, homemakers or sports fans or whomever it is what they actually think about their product, right? That's the idea of, like, we just want to know what's up for you. Well, can we do this on a much deeper and more sincere level with actual, you know, people in our lives who aren't getting a, you know, box of donuts and $100 for coming? Right, the idea of, can I get your will? Can I walk a mile in your shoes? If you can do that, right, the results can be powerful. And to extend the Aikido analogies, just because there's so many good ones that apply to this, is one of the first moves in Aikido as someone's coming to attack or strike you is to step aside, so step out of the way of that baseball bat or fist, right, and actually come and turn. And look, you're almost like a tango move, where you're now connected to that person, looking in the same direction. You literally, physically take on their perspective and point of view. But by the way, you've also got your hand on their head. So now that I understand where you're looking, and I, you know, sort of metaphorically or literally control your head, oh, by the way, yes, we're great, this is compassionate, and I share your point of view. I can also move you or throw you any place I choose to. If I control your head, right, I control where you go. So even if you need to be just straight up Machiavellian about this stuff, right, in order to give yourself permission to, right, the notion of deeply getting someone's world leaves them absolutely there and available to be moved or persuaded. But the key is you have to do it authentically. You have to do it honestly, and you have to leave them feeling that you have got their world without an agenda. Now, here's the cool part. This is what we were talking about when Stephen and I riff on ideas together, right? And if and as we get through the, you know, pissing match of who's got the better idea, and we actually get to the place where there's this thing, like for jazz musicians, right? It's that around midnight idea of, like, what happens when those guys really start cooking. And instead of me playing the same thing I played for the last five nights in a row and my drummer knows Stone Cold, instead, something different comes up. That, and then everybody sits up, and then he adds a little flourish, and then the dancers start dancing a little more, and the next thing you know, there's that magic that happens, that collective flow state. That's what we're looking to do, is number three, co-create a shared reality.
Jamie, I'm going to jump in for a second because I just want to emphasize. So if you've read Rise of Superman and you've looked at the acknowledgments, four or five of the chapters in Rise, you know, came out of exactly this process. You know, they're as much Jamie as they are me, and I have, you know, so much of them were co-created in this last 30 space, right, this space of ambiguity where, you know, you have the emergent properties of ideas neither of us saw coming, simply because we were willing to back down and kind of try to share perspectives on the way, and, you know, always sort of aim for group flow in that way. The results were phenomenal, and, you know, the coolest part about it is that when you're in it and you're having that experience, and this could be interpersonally in a relationship, or it could be, you know, like what Jamie and I were doing when we were working on Rise, it feels like magic, right? It's an emergent property. This kind of creativity where ideas come together and you get the gamma spike in the brain, and things come together for the very first time out of nowhere, it always feels like magic. It's one of the greatest feelings on earth, right? It's a feeling of deep, deep, deep hope because you've just created options, which is something we all want all the time. We have a built-in seeking system, and what the seeking system wants most is positive options, creative options, to move forward. And, you know, when you actually get a yes, when that happens, the reward is incredible. It's so deeply motivating, and it feels magical, and the ideas are so much bigger than either myself or Jamie could have come up with on our own.
Yeah, absolutely. So guys, this is a doozy. This is one of those assignments super tempting and easy just to punt on. to have had it on your list of things to do, but you don't, because it's obviously it's scary and it's outside of all of our comfort zones. But this one potentially, I mean, if you took nothing else from this course other than like understanding there is a flow cycle and, you know, what's the value of struggle and recovery, if you took nothing else besides that and this, I think it would be a powerful change, you know, for the better, in personal life and leadership. So the idea here is, how do we find a relationship that keeps us up at night? A relationship where we have those conversations in our head, you know, as we're driving home from work, right? Figure out one of those. And at the simplest level, show you can do step one by yourself, right? How can I, where is there gratitude for me to experience here, right? Behind every complaint is a commitment. So if I have a complaint about someone, right? That's obviously why I'm rehashing conversations in my head at night in the car. If I've got a complaint, it's because I care. It's because I have a commitment to that relationship being something different, right? So focus on that. I am committed to that. That's where I can come to the gratitude from. So do that on your own ahead of time. And then just show up. And if it's, you know, if it's a conversation that's, you know, a little bit of a groundhog day, you guys, you've had this before, both parties are a little bit fatigued or tired or think they know where it's going to go again this time, set the condition. Hey, I just want to fully understand this. Ask good leading questions. Just try and get their will. Your goal, and you can repeat language back to them. So what I'm hearing you say is this what it's like for you? Just try and get their will. That's it. And the secret pro tip is number three. There is no number three. Right? The reality is if you do number two deeply and sincerely, number three self-assembles. Okay, so don't be in two itching to get to number three, where you really get to reassert your 100% view with a couple of bolt-ons, right? Do number two, and three will take care of itself. Okay? So what that does is that gives us our homework, and this is what it looks like. So the first thing is who, where, and when. Are you going with whom, technically, where and when are you going to attempt your first 30-30-30 practice this week? Okay, so go ahead and jot that down right now. There's about a 20% plus greater likelihood of pulling off any new habit or act if we actually visualize and name time and location. So think about the person. You probably already know it. You might want to punt because you're thinking, oh, shit, I'm actually going to have to do this, but don't. Right? Pick that person. And then figure out where am I going to do it and when. This week. So if it's a long-distance relationship, ideally try and have it be the highest fidelity, most data-rich form of communication you can, meaning email is lost, don't do it. Phones, better but still crappy. Skype or Google Hangouts, far better than just a landline. And obviously in-person, best of all. Okay, so figure that out and then figure when. And if you would, going to hold your feet to the fire this time, go ahead and put that in your calendar right now. And it can just be your name hyphen their name talk. You can make it a discrete neutral calendar heading. And actually, go and plug it in. And I'm sure your prefrontal cortexes are kicking into overdrive right now, filled with excuses, outrageous indignation, and or lethargy and distraction. Your urge to go check your Facebook account suddenly went through the roof. But put this in your calendar anyway with a reminder. Okay? And then do it. And then report back. So I would love you to post that on Flow Hacker Nation. Public accountability is another anchor that helps us stick with this stuff. The 5 minutes is the sleep practice. Please go ahead and continue just having the sleep tracker app and monitoring your sleep. Is it getting better? Is it getting worse? Does it vary according to stress levels at work? In fact, I had one CEO that I was working with. We were doing exactly these kinds of programs. And he's like, oh, yeah, I mean, it was great Monday through Thursday. Monday through Thursday, it just kind of sucked. It was all over the place. I was getting, you know, less than 90 minutes of REM sleep a night. Friday, Saturday, man, were awesome. And I was like, huh, how's that going for you? So clearly, we can get quick reads on that. He was also having a very different caffeine intake during the work week. So pay attention to those things, sleep as recovery, right? The 15 minutes, we just added a body scan to this notion of what are we doing for our sort of physiological and cognitive awareness, literally the body-brain connection. So we just added the body scan, and please also considering the Stress Doctor app, right, and the Art of Flow video. And the Flow Trigger Action Plan, if you had an opportunity to conduct your mild, medium, spicy flow triggers last week, please go ahead and post some of those adventures and stories on our Flow Hacker Nation page. And then the real key is this 30-30-30 game, okay? And if you want to, you know, if you want to set yourself up for the best success possible, would highly recommend either doing the body scan or 5 minutes of the Stress Doctor prior. It's just going to help you relax, flush any needless nervousness, tension, or anxiety. And back to that, I'm going to hold down the beat. I'm going to know where the one is, right? It'll help prime your body, brain, and mind to be more resourceful in that conversation, okay? When you have the conversation, just focus on first accepting it as it is and finding a way to be grateful for it, and then just getting someone's world. So really, step one is just how do I show up cleanly, positively, neutral? And step two is just play that game of deeply getting their world. Okay? Don't correct. Don't reinterpret. Don't assign character value or attributions. Right? Just imagine that you're a sort of, you know, you're an anthropologist just trying to get the most accurate description of this person's world. Okay? And then please jump into Flow Hacker Nation. I've been loving seeing your questions and comments. And absolutely another key part, and again, this is another small risk, is just to go out there, stick your neck out, report back on what's happening for you, ask questions, answer other people's questions, share information. It's a great way for all of us to really enliven and embody this work so that it's not just geeking out about the the newest kind of neurohackery, and it actually becomes a practice and a community that can actually meaningfully improve our lives and our work. So with that, we are at the conclusion of class four. I want to thank everybody for attending, for listening in all the different formats and times, when and where you have the ability. If you are listening solo versus while we're live, please, please, for yourself, hold your feet to the fire. No one can do your push-ups for you, and conducting these practices is actually where it happens. And with that, I just want to leave it with Stephen for any last words, and then look forward to seeing you guys on Flow Hacker Nation. Stephen.
Thanks, Jamie. That was really excellent, thinking on the 30-30-30. I like how you broke that down. I want to emphasize how ridiculously life-changing the 30-30-30 exercise can really be. Forget everything else for flow at a relationship level. It opens up, whether it's, your wife, your girlfriend, your boyfriend, your boss, somebody you work with, just a friend. This game really, really changes things, and it opens up a whole new possibility space, and it makes a lot of, by opening up this possibility space, it makes a lot of new space in your life for group flow. And as Jamie said, flow is a muscle, individual flow is a muscle, group flow is a muscle, and you can really fine-tune it. And it's really worth doing. The 30-30-30 exercise, as uncomfortable as it may sound, really will produce some amazing changes. So go forth, have fun, and be comfortable being uncomfortable. And we'll see you next week.